Welcome to today's deep dive. Imagine for a second a lifeline, one that delivers exact life-sustaining nutrition and medication directly into the human body.
It sounds so simple on the surface, doesn't it?
Right. But if you've ever actually managed one of these lifelines, you know that keeping it functioning takes the precision of a master engineer and the vigilance of a seasoned detective.
Oh, absolutely. It's a massive undertaking.
Yeah. So today we are digging into a huge stack of clinical data. We've got order sets from Island Health, advanced nursing skill modules on enteral nutrition, and some really dense textbook chapters detailing the management of feeding tubes.
And honestly, it is an incredible amount of clinical intelligence to synthesize. We're looking at the exact mechanics of access, the biochemistry behind those specialized formulas, and the really rigid laboratory schedules you need to prevent catastrophic metabolic shifts. For sure. And our mission for this deep dive is to completely demystify this highly calibrated world of enteral therapy. Since you, our listener, are probably already familiar with the day-to-day realities of patient care, we're going to just bypass the elementary definitions entirely.
Right. No need to define what a stomach is here.
Exactly. Whether you're a caregiver managing complex patients on the floor, prepping for rounds, or just, you know, insanely curious about how human anatomy meets medical engineering, we are going to reveal the hidden mechanical, chemical, and procedural marvels happening right at the bedside.
It really is a marvel.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the sheer engineering of the access devices themselves is wild. We are not just talking about standard pliable tubing here.
No, far from it. The architecture of access is this highly specialized field of material science and anatomical routing.
Mm.
I mean, you know the standard routes, the NG and NG tubes going through the nose, but the structural designs meant for long-term placement are where the engineering really shines.
Right, like when you look at the G tubes and J tubes, the ones surgically or percutaneously inserted directly into the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
The physical anchors keeping these devices flush against the gastric mucosa are just fascinating. The diagrams in our sources show these internal mushroom catheter tips for some G-tubes.
Yeah, mushroom tips.
It literally acts like a flexible little umbrella that deploys inside the stomach so it doesn't pull out. And for patients who need a more flush fit, you see these non-obturated, low-profile balloon fixation devices.
Those are incredible pieces of design.
They really are. It's a tiny, perfectly calibrated balloon inflated with sterile water right inside the stomach to keep the stoma sealed, and the device totally secure against the skin. It basically minimizes the risk of gastric leakage.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the decision of which specific access architecture to deploy isn't random. It's highly calculated. A physician has to evaluate the patient's entire gastrointestinal motility and their structural anatomy.
So they can't just pick a tube out of a catalog.
Exactly. Say gastric emptying is compromised. In that case, a J tube, which goes straight into the intestines, bypassing the stomach entirely, is mechanically necessary. And they also have to project the exact timeline the patient will require enteral nutrition and match the durability of the silicone or polyurethane to that timeline.
But with all these different lines going into a single patient, the clinical data highlights a terrifying and probably familiar risk to anyone who has worked in an ICU.
Oh, the misconnections.
Yes, enteral feeding misconnections. Mm. If you've ever looked closely at an IV pole, you know it is a visual nightmare of fluids. You basically have to play a high-stakes game of untangling Christmas lights.
That's a great way to put it.
Except if you plug the wrong string in, the consequences are instantly fatal.
It genuinely remains one of the most critical mechanical safety issues in modern healthcare. The human brain is prone to fatigue.
Mm.
And historically, Luer-Lock syringes actually allowed enteral tubes to physically connect to intravenous lines.
Which is terrifying.
It is. So providers essentially have to act like meticulous electricians now to prevent pumping a dense peptide-based formula directly into a patient's bloodstream. The protocols demand physical tracing.
Meaning you can't just eyeball it.
Right. You don't just look at the line. You put your hand on it and you trace it from the bag through the pump down to the exact insertion site on the patient.
And the routing rules are so brilliant in their simplicity. 4V lines are universally routed toward the patient's head, and enteral lines are routed toward the patient's feet.
It creates an immediate visual disruption if a line crosses that invisible boundary.
Plus, the industry has aggressively updated the physical connectors themselves. The guidelines explicitly state you should never force pieces together. If a connector doesn't thread naturally, it is a massive tactile warning sign.
Yeah, you never adapt or splice these devices. The physical incompatibility of, say, an ENFit connector with an IV port is the ultimate safety net. It completely removes human error from the equation.
So once the correct access is actually secured, the engineering of the delivery comes into play. You've got continuous feeding using those precisely calibrated electronic pumps, delivering fractional volumes every hour, or intermittent bolus feeding using gravity or a syringe to mimic, you know, a normal physiological meal expansion in the stomach.
Right, expanding the stomach naturally.
But the formulas themselves, that is pure clinical biochemistry. We are not talking about pureed hospital food here.
No, absolutely not. These are highly engineered, osmotically balanced pharmacological agents.
The market for these clinical formulas is incredibly specific. The literature mentions brands like Isosource, Nutrin, Peptamen, and Nepro. And Nepro even formulates these targeted therapeutic nutrition shakes. They're designed for super precise metabolic states.
Yeah, it's tailored to the exact GI function.
Right. Like if you have a patient with a compromised gut lining, you can't just give them complex proteins. You have to use a formula like Peptamen, which provides pre-digested peptides that the jejunum can absorb without even needing pancreatic enzymes.
But that perfect nutrient-dense profile comes with a severe biological catch. Because these formulas are essentially the perfect culture medium for bacterial growth, the protocols enforce a strict ticking clock of spoilage.
Ah, the hang times.
Yes, the hang times are absolute. For an open system, where a clinician physically pours the formula into a delivery bag, the absolute maximum hang time at room temperature is 8 hours.
Wait, I actually have to push back on that for a second.
Sure.
If it's a sterile hospital environment and the bag is sealed after pouring, why is the bacterial risk so aggressive compared to something like a standard IV saline drip hanging for days?
That's a really great question, and it all comes down to the log phase of bacterial replication. See, saline has zero nutritional value. Bacteria cannot metabolize it. But enteral formulas, they are packed with carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins.
Oh, so it's a buffet.
Exactly. And it's at an optimal pH for pathogens. Even a microscopic introduction of fluor from the air, or just a clinician's glove during the pour, will hit exponential growth within hours.
Wow. And it gets even stricter, right? Because if you're dealing with a powdered formula that requires manual reconstitution with water, you only get 4 hours.
Only 4 hours. The addition of non-sterile tap water, or even sterile water that's exposed room air during mixing, massively accelerates that colonization risk.
So what happens to the rest of the formula if you don't use it all?
Any unused open formula can live in the refrigerator, but strictly for 24 hours. And those physical feeding bags and lines, they have to be completely replaced every 24 hours. Pushing those boundaries means you risk introducing a massive bacterial load directly into the patient's GI tract, which triggers severe systemic distress.
There is also this visual warning in the nursing management tables that really caught my eye regarding the formula bags themselves. A 3-in-1 parenteral nutrition bag, the IV bag containing lipids, amino acids, and dextrose meant for the central line, looks dangerously, almost identically similar to an opaque enteral formula bag.
They are nearly indistinguishable at a glance. Both are milky, white to yellowish fluids hanging from the exact same pole.
Which sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It really is, which necessitates massive, aggressive warning labels on the enteral bags reading, "Warning, for enteral use only, not for Vovi." It's a vital visual stopgap for the tired clinician working a 3 a.m. night shift.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the tube isn't just a conduit for these specialized formulas. It is the primary vector for hydration and medication. And that requires an incredibly strict mixology of tube flushing.
Oh yes, the mixology.
If you've ever had to push a crushed med through a clogged J-tube, you know exactly how frustrating and dangerous a loss of patency can be.
A feeding tube has to remain patent at all times. If it clogs, the lifeline is severed. And replacing a migrated J-tube isn't just a minor inconvenience. It requires radiological or surgical intervention.
Right. So to maintain that patency, the Island Health Clinical Order sets mandate a standard flush of 60 milliliters of water every 4 hours for continuous feeds, or a prophylactic flush before and after every single bolus feed.
And when you introduce pharmacology into this environment, the rules become totally uncompromising.
Liquid is absolutely king. If a medication is available in a liquid solution or a suspension, that is the default. But if you must use a tablet, it has to be crushed into a superfine powder and dissolved completely in warm water.
And no batching them together.
Right. You can't just play bartender, mixing 5 different meds into a single cup and pushing them down the line. Medications must be administered sequentially, one at a time, separated by a 10 to 15 milliliter warm water flush.
That separation is absolutely critical to prevent chemical incompatibilities. Mixing drugs can alter their pH, which can cause them to crystallize or coagulate into a concrete-like substance right inside the polyurethane lumen.
Concrete in the tube, not good.
Not good at all. But beyond the physical mechanics, the pharmacological boundaries are what really matter here.
Right.
The do not crush list is treated as absolute gospel.
Yes. You never crush enteric-coated tablets, sublinguals, or sustained-release capsules. As you know, crushing an enteric coating destroys the barrier meant to protect the stomach lining from the drug, or the drug from the stomach acid. And crushing a sustained-release capsule, that instantly converts a 12-hour steady dose into an immediate, potentially lethal bolus of medication hitting the bloodstream all at once.
But we really must consider the occupational hazard to the healthcare worker here, too. You never, ever crush cytotoxic or teratogenic medications.
This is a huge point in the sources. Crushing these powerful chemotherapeutic or cellular altering drugs doesn't just ruin the pill, it aerosolizes it.
Yes, exactly.
It releases microscopic teratogenic dust into the air of the ward, causing immediate and dangerous inhalation exposure to the nurse preparing it.
The stakes of administration are incredibly high, and all of this precise flushing and specific crushing is ultimately deployed to fight the greatest mechanical enemy of enteral therapy, the clog. The data notes that improperly crushed medications in coagulated, curdled formula are the primary culprits for total tube obstruction.
When that obstruction happens, you have to bring out the specialized equipment. Clinicians use a 60-milliliter EnFit syringe to attempt to clear the line. And here is a counterintuitive piece of physics for you. They use the large 60-milliliter syringe specifically because a smaller syringe, like a 10-milliliter, actually generates significantly higher pressure.
Which sounds backward, but it's true.
Right. And that high pressure from a small syringe can easily rupture the internal tubing. Though, of course, pediatric considerations change the volume game. You still use the appropriate syringe size, but a pediatric patient might only tolerate a 1 to 2 milliliter flush for a small tube, or maybe 5 to 15 milliliters for a larger one, just to prevent dangerous fluid overload.
So we have the hemodynamics of the flush down, the flow rates calibrated, and the medications dissolving perfectly. But frankly, none of that matters if the tube is migrated.
Right. How do you actually know that NG tube hasn't curled up into the esophagus? Or worse, slipped quietly past the vocal cords and into the lungs? The detective work at the bedside is just nonstop.
Verification is an ongoing dynamic process. The moment you assume a tube is placed correctly is the exact moment you put the patient at massive risk.
The textbooks confirm that a radiographic X-ray is the absolute gold standard for verifying initial placement. But as you know, ordering a chest X-ray every 4 hours before a med pass is clinically impossible. It's absurdly expensive, and it subjects the patient to unacceptable levels of cumulative radiation.
So clinicians have to rely on an aggregate of bedside clues. First is the external measurement. If the tube was secured at the 50-centimeter mark at the nair yesterday, and today it's resting at 60 centimeters, it has migrated inward.
And if it's at 40, it's pulled out.
Exactly. But because a tube can easily coil upon itself inside the stomach without altering the external length at all, they must aspirate and test the fluid.
They pull a sample of the aspirate and test it on a highly specific 1.0 to 11.0 pH scale. Since gastric acid is exceptionally corrosive, a highly acidic pH of around 1 to 5 gives you solid confidence the tip is resting in the stomach. But I have to ask, isn't this complicated by modern pharmacy?
How so?
Well, what if the patient is on pantoprazole or a heavy H2 blocker? Doesn't that completely artificially raise the gastric pH?
It does. That is precisely why you cannot rely on a single metric. If the patient is on proton pump inhibitors, the pH might read as a 6 or 7, which mimics the pH of the lungs or the intestines. Therefore, visual assessment of the aspirate is equally heavily weighted.
So what are they looking for?
Gastric aspirate is typically cloudy, grassy green, or off-white. Intestinal aspirate, however, is a very distinct translucent yellow or brownish-green because it is heavily stained by bile. If you pull up bile, you instantly know that tube has crossed the pyloric sphincter. It's all about layering these data points to build a case for safety before a single drop of formula flows.
And even when the placement is absolutely perfect, the body can still violently reject the process. The complication tables from the Brenner textbook categorize these rejections into three domains: mechanical, gastrointestinal, and metabolic.
The mechanical ones are scary.
Very. The most dreaded mechanical complication is aspiration pneumonia. Formula regurgitates from the stomach and slides directly into the pulmonary tree. To combat this, physics, specifically gravity, is your best defense. The strict protocol demands the head of the bed must be elevated at a 30 to 45 degree angle during the entirety of a continuous feed, and for at least 30 to 60 minutes after a bolus feed. Lying a patient flat while formula is flowing is a never event.
But we must address the gastrointestinal rebellions. Diarrhea is the most ubiquitous complication, and the bedside detective work has to instantly pivot to find the etiology.
Right. Why is it happening?
Exactly. Is the osmolarity of the formula too high, causing dumping syndrome? Is the pump rate too aggressive? Was the formula administered cold, causing gastric cramping? Or, more concerningly, is it an iatrogenic complication like broad-spectrum antibiotics, wiping out the gut flora and triggering a C. diff infection?
On the flip side, they can suffer severe constipation from a low-residue formula or insufficient free water flushes. And if the patient experiences acute nausea or begins vomiting, you have to assess the gastric residual volume. You attach that syringe and pull back to see exactly how much formula is just pooling undigested in the stomach.
And the numbers matter there.
Big time. If you aspirate 200 milliliters or more, that stomach has stopped emptying. The protocol is fascinating here, though. You actually reinstill that 200 milliliters back into the stomach so you don't instantly crash their electrolyte balance, but you immediately hold the feed and report it.
You mentioned the electrolyte balance, which seamlessly transitions us into the third domain, the invisible metabolic risks. Enteral patients are highly susceptible to silent shifts. They face dehydration, azotemia, which is the accumulation of urea nitrogen in the blood, and profound hyperglycemia.
Because of the sugar in the formula.
Exactly. These clinical formulas carry a massive carbohydrate load that the stressed pancreas often cannot match with endogenous insulin.
Because these risks are entirely invisible at the bedside, the Island Health Order sets mandate a rigorous, highly structured laboratory schedule. Before the pump is even turned on, they draw baseline panels. They check electrolytes, creatinine, a random glucose, magnesium, phosphorus, and C-reactive protein just to gauge baseline systemic inflammation.
And that surveillance doesn't stop. They run recurring labs, typically electrolytes, creatinine, mag, and force, every single Monday for the first 3 weeks to map how the renal and metabolic systems are adapting.
But if a patient presents as severely malnourished, the threat of refeeding syndrome changes the timeline entirely.
Refeeding syndrome is terrifying.
For those who haven't seen it, when a starved body is suddenly hit with a massive influx of carbohydrates, insulin spikes. That insulin rapidly drives glucose into the cells, but it drags all the serum, phosphorus, potassium, and magnesium into the cells right along with it.
Exactly. It causes a profound, sudden intracellular shift. The serum levels of those critical electrolytes plummet dangerously low in the blood, which can trigger immediate fatal cardiac arrhythmias.
So to intercept this, those at-risk patients require daily lab draws for the first 3 to 4 days of feeding to aggressively replace electrolytes before the heart is compromised.
It's intense monitoring.
So what does this all mean? When you step back and look at the sheer density of these protocols, the tactile feedback of the ENFit connectors, the log phase bacterial math dictating hang times, the precise 30-degree elevation of the bed, the daily metabolic surveillance for intracellular shifts, it completely reframes the concept of clinical nutrition.
It truly does. Enteral feeding is infinitely more complex than the layperson's understanding of just delivering food.
It is a massive, highly choreographed medical operation. You are balancing physics, using fluid dynamics and gravity. You're balancing chemistry, managing drug solubility and acidic pH gradients. You're navigating structural anatomy, and you are executing unyielding safety protocols to keep these vulnerable patients not just nourished, but actively protected from fatal systemic complications.
What's fascinating here is, throughout this entire analysis, we've focused almost exclusively on the hard science. We've detailed the chemical toll of medications, the exact degree of bed elevation, the physiological cascade of refeeding syndrome, but buried in the initial nursing assessment guidelines, a brief line in the sources, is a directive to monitor the patient's psychosocial adjustment and body image.
That is a remarkably heavy, often overlooked layer of this whole process.
It is profound. As you go about your shift today, or as you review your next patient's chart, consider this. How might the deep psychological trauma of losing the fundamental human ability to eat, to taste food, to chew, to participate in the social communion of a shared meal, combined with the permanent physical presence of synthetic tubing protruding from the abdomen, actually influence a patient's physiological tolerance of the very nutrition keeping them alive?
Wow.
The enteric nervous system and the human mind are inextricably linked. We can measure phosphorus and we can measure pH, but that psychological adjustment might be the most complex, unquantifiable complication of them.
That is an incredible thought to end on, and a vital reminder that behind every polyurethane tube, every calibrated pump, and every Monday morning lab result, there is a human being navigating a profoundly altered reality. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the protocols, keep looking for the bigger physiological picture, and keep learning. We'll catch you next time.